Chapter 3. They buried West in 12 degrees 35 minutes north, 152 degrees 17 minutes west. And some days later his clothes, according to the custom of the sea, were sold at the mainmast. Henry Veedle, a master mariner shipping as a forecastle hand for this voyage, bought West's formal coat and breeches. He and his nipper-dolling friends removed all the lace and any ornament that could be taken for a mark of rank, and it was in these severe garments that he presented himself on his promotion to acting second lieutenant for his first dinner in the gunroom. For this occasion, too, Stephen dined below, but the nature of the present feast was entirely different. For one thing, the ship was still a great way from her settled routine. There was still a great deal to be done aboard the frigate and in the Franklin, and this could not be the leisurely ceremony with which Granger had been welcomed. For another, the atmosphere was much too like that of a civilian gathering, three of the eight people having nothing whatsoever to do with the Navy. At the foot of the table, on either side of Mr. Adams, sat two ransomers, men taken from her prizes by the Franklin as security for the sum the ships had agreed to pay for their release. In Pulling's absence, Granger was at the head, with Stephen on his right and Veedle on his left, while in the middle of the table Martin sat opposite Dutol, invited by Adams on a hint from the captain. It was therefore much less of an ordeal for Veedle. There was no intimidating gold lace. Many of the people were as much strangers to the table as he was himself, and he was very well with his neighbours, Granger, whom he had known from boyhood, and Dutor, whom he found particularly sympathetic, while Dr. Maturin, his shipmate in three commissions, was not a man to put a newcomer out of countenance. Indeed, after their first kindly welcome of the new officer, there was no need for taking any special care of him. Veedle joined in the fine, steady flow of talk, and presently Stephen, abandoning his social duties as he so often did, confined himself to his dinner, his wine, and to contemplating his messmates. The ransomers on either side of Adams, the one a supercargo and the other a merchant, both out of fur traders, were still in the full joy of their liberation, and sometimes they laughed for no reason whatsoever, while a joke such as, "What answer was given to him that dissuaded one from marrying a wife because she was now wiser?" "I desire," said he, "my wife should have no more wit than to be able to distinguish my bed from another man's," threw them into convulsions. It was noticeable that they were both on good terms with Dutor, and this did not seem to Stephen to be merely the result of their being set free, but a settled state of affairs. As for Dutor himself, Stephen already knew him pretty well in his present condition, since Dutor came every day to visit those Franklins who had been brought across to be cared for in the Surprise's capacious sick berth. Stephen necessarily spoke French to these patients, and with such frequent contact it would have been childish to conceal his fluency. Dutor, for his part, took it for granted and made no comment, any more than Stephen took notice of Dutor's English, remarkably exact and idiomatic, though occasionally marked by the nasal twang of the northern colonies in which he had spent some early years. He was sitting there in the middle of the table, upright, buoyant, wearing a light blue coat and his own hair, cropped in the Brutus fashion, talking away right and left, suiting himself to his company and apparently enjoying his dinner, yet he had lost everything, and that everything was sailing along under the lee of the Surprise, commanded by those who had taken him prisoner. Insensibility? Stoicism? Magnanimity? Stephen could not tell. But it was certainly not mere levity, for what Stephen did know was that Dutor was a highly intelligent man with an inquiring, not to say an inquisitive, mind. He was now engaged in extracting an account of English municipal government from Veedle, his right-hand neighbour, and Stephen's vis-à-vis. Veedle was a middle-aged seaman with much of the dignity that Stephen had often observed in those who were masters of their trade. Yet apart from his earrings, one would scarcely have taken him for a sailor. His face, though tanned mahogany, was more that of a good-natured reading man, and it would have been no surprise to see him reach for a pair of spectacles. He had the habitual gravity expected of an elder, but his expression was far from humourless. There was nothing of the holy Joe about him, and he was perfectly at home in a ribald, profane ship's company and in a bloody, close-fought action. He laughed at his messmates' medieval jokes, at the young men's occasional horseplay, and at the facetiousness of his cousin the boatswain. But no one at any time would have attempted to make game of him. Stephen's mind wandered away on the subject of authority. its nature, origin, base, or bases, authority, whether innate or acquired, and if acquired, then by what means, authority as opposed to mere power, how exactly to be defined, its etymology, its relation to auctor. From these thoughts he was aroused by an expectant silence opposite him, and looking up he saw Dutor and Vida looking at him across the table, their forks poised. Reaching back in his mind, he caught the echo of a question. What do you think of democracy?
The gentleman was asking what you thought of democracy, sir, said Veedle, smiling.
Alas, I cannot tell you, sir, said Stephen, returning the smile. For although it would not be proper to call this bark or vessel a king's ship, except in the largest sense, we nevertheless adhere strictly to the naval tradition which forbids the discussion of religion, women, or politics in our mess. It has been objected that this rule makes for insipidity, which may be so, yet on the other hand it has its uses, since in this case, for example, it prevents any member from wounding any other gentleman present by saying that he did not think the policy that put Socrates to death and that left Athens prostrate was the highest expression of human wisdom, or by quoting Aristotle's definition of democracy as mob rule, the depraved version of a commonwealth.
Can you suggest a better system? Asked Dutor.
Sir, said Stephen, my words were those of some hypothetical person. Where my own views are concerned, tradition seals my mouth. As I have told you, we do not discuss politics at this table.
Quite right, too, called out the merchant on Adam's left. If there is one thing I hate more than topics, it is politics. Damn all talk of Whigs, Tories, and Radicals, say I, and damn all topics too, like the state of the poor and slavery and reform. Let us talk about the enclosing of commons, annuities, and South Sea stock, like this gentleman here, and how to make two groats where only one grew before.
He clapped Martin on the shoulder and repeated,
"Two groats where only one grew before."
I'm very sorry to have offended against your tradition, gentlemen, said Dutor, recollecting himself. But I am no seaman, and I have never before had the honour of sitting down in an English officer's mess.
A glass of wine with you, sir, said Stephen, bowing to him across the table.
It had been foreseen that with so much work to do inboard and out, the dinner would come to an early end, and once the cloth was drawn it moved on quickly to the loyal toast.
You understand, sir, said Granger to Dutor in terms that he had prepared beforehand, that those parties who have not the happiness of being his subjects are not required to drink the king.
You are very good, sir, replied Dutor, but I am perfectly willing to drink to the gentleman's good health. God bless him.
Shortly after this the table emptied, and Stephen and Martin took a turn on the quarter-deck until six bells, when they were invited to drink coffee with the captain, who, however hungry he might be, was required by custom to dine later than anyone else. After the shadowy gunroom, the full day was almost intolerably bright, a blue day with white clouds sailing on the warm breeze, a white ripple on the small cross-seas, no marked roll or pitch. They paced up and down with their eyes narrowed until they became used to the brilliance, and Martin said,
"An odd, somewhat disturbing thing happened to me this morning. I was coming back from the Franklin when Johnson pointed out a bird, a small pale bird that overtook us, circled the boat and flew on, certainly a petrel and probably a Hahnemann's. Yet although I watched it with a certain pleasure, I suddenly realised that I did not really care. I did not mind what it was called."
"We have never yet seen Hahnemann's petrel."
"No, that was what made it so disturbing. I must not compare great things with small, but one hears of men losing their faith, waking up one morning and finding that they do not believe in the creed they must recite to the congregation in a few hours' time. One does, too, and on a scale of infinitely less consequence but still distressing, there was a cousin of mine in the County Down who found, one morning, just as you say, that he no longer loved the young woman to whom he had made an offer. She was the same young woman, with the same physical advantages and the same accomplishments. She had done nothing reprehensible, but he did not love her.
What did the poor man do?
He married her.
Was the marriage happy?
When you look about among your acquaintances, do you find many happy marriages?
Martin considered.
No, he said, I do not. My own is very happy, however,
And with that, nodding over the water at the prize, it is likely to be even happier. All the hands who have been on the Nootka run say she is extremely rich, and sometimes I wonder whether, with such a wife, a parish, and the promise of preferment, I am justified in leading my present wandering life, delightful though it may be on such a day as this.
Six bells, and they hurried down the companion ladder.
"Come in, gentlemen, come in!" cried Jack.
He was always a little over-cordial with Martin, whom he did not like very much, and whom he did not invite as often as he felt he should. Killick's arrival with a coffee, and his mates with little toasted slices of dried breadfruit, masked the slight, the very slight awkwardness, and when they were all sitting comfortably, holding their little cups, and gazing out of the sweep of windows that formed the aftermost wall of the great cabin, Jack asked,
"What news of your instrument, Mr. Martin?"
The instrument in question was a viola, upon which, before it was broken, Martin played indifferently, having an uncertain ear and an imperfect sense of time. No one had expected to hear it again this voyage, or at least not until they touched a Callao. But the fortune of war had brought them a French repairer, a craftsman who had been sent to Louisiana for a variety of crimes, mostly crapulous, and who, escaping from bondage, had joined the Franklin. "Gourin says that Mr. Bentley has promised him a piece of lignum vitae as soon as he has a moment to spare. Then it will be only half a day's work, and time for the glue to dry."
"I am so glad," said Jack. "We must have some more music one of these days. There is another thing I wanted to ask, for you know a great deal about the various religious persuasions, as I recall."
"I should, sir, because in the days when I was only an unbeneficed clergyman," said Martin, with a bow towards his patron, "I translated the whole of Muller's great book, wrote my version out again in a fair copy, saw it through the press, and corrected two sets of proofs. Every word I read five times, and some very curious sects did I come across. There were the Assetons, for example, who used to dance round an inflated wineskin."
"The people I should like to know about are the Nipperdollings."
"Our Nipperdollings?"
"Oh, Nipperdollings in general. I do not mean anything personal."
"Well, sir, historically they were the followers of Bernhard Nipperdolling, one of those Munster Anabaptists who went to such very ill-considered lengths, enforcing equality and the community of goods, and then going on to polygamy. John of Leiden had four wives at a time, one of them being Nipperdolling's daughter, and I am afraid that even worse disorders followed. Yet I think they left little in the way of doctrinal posterity, unless they can be said to live on in the Socinians and Mennonites, which few would accept. Those who use the name at present are descendants of the Levellers. The Levellers, as you will recall, sir, were a party with strong republican views in the Civil War. They wished to level all differences of rank, reducing the nation to an equality. And some of them wanted land to be held in common, no private ownership of land. They were very troublesome in the army and the state. They earned a thoroughly bad name, and eventually they were put down, leaving only a few scattered communities. I believe the Levellers as a body did not have a religious as opposed to a social or political unity, though I cannot think that any of them belonged to the established church. Yet some of these remaining communities formed a sect with strange notions of the Trinity and a dislike of infant baptism. And to avoid the odium attached to the name of Levellers, and indeed the persecutions, they called themselves Nipperdollings, thinking that more respectable, or at least more obscure. I imagine they knew very little of the Nipperdollings' religious teaching, but had retained a traditional knowledge of their notions of social justice, which made them think the name appropriate."
"It is remarkable," observed Stephen after a pause, "that the Surprise, with her many sects, should be such a peaceful ship. To be sure, there was that slight want of harmony between the Sethians and the Nipperdollings at Botany Bay, and in passing I may once more point out, sir, that if this vessel supplied her people with round rather than square plates, these differences would be slighter still. For you are to consider that a square plate has four corners, each one of which makes it more than a mere contending instrument." He perceived from the civil inclinations of Captain Aubrey's head and the reserved expression on his face that the square plates issued to the Surprise when she was captured from the French in 1796 would retain their lethal corners as long as he or any other right-minded sea officer commanded her. The Royal Navy's traditions were not to be changed for the sake of a few broken heads. Stephen continued. "But generally speaking, there is no discord at all, whereas very often the least difference of opinion leads to downright hatred."
"That may be because they tend to leave their particular observances on shore," said Martin. "The Thraskites are a Judaizing body, and they would recoil from a ham at Shelmiston, but here they eat up their salt pork, aye, and fresh too, when they can get it, and then when we rig church on Sundays, they and all the others sing the Anglican psalms and hymns with great goodwill."
"For my own part," said Captain Aubrey, "I have no notion of disliking a man for his beliefs, above all if he was born with them. I find I can get along very well with Jews, or even—"
The P of Papists was already formed, and the word was obliged to come out as Pindus. Yet it had hardly fallen upon Stephen's ear before a shriek and the crash of glass expelled embarrassment. Young Arthur Weddell, a ransomer of Reed's age, who lived and messed in the midshipman's berth, fell through the skylight into the cabin. Reed had been deprived of youthful company for a great while, and although he was often invited to the gunroom and the cabin, he missed it sorely. At first, Norton, though a great big fellow for his age, had been too bashful to be much of a companion in the berth, but now that Arthur had been added to them, his shyness wore away entirely, and the three made enough noise for 30, laughing and hooting far into the night, playing cricket on the tween decks when the hammocks were out of the way, or football in the vacant larboard berth when they were not. But this was the first time they had ever hurled one of their number into the cabin.
"Mr. Granger," said Jack,
when it had been found that Weddell was not materially injured, and when the lieutenant had been summoned from the head,
"Mr. Weddell will jump up to the mizzen masthead immediately, Mr. Norton to the fore, and you will have Mr. Reed whipped up to the main. They will stay there until I call them down. Pass the word for the carpenter, or for my joiner, if Mr. Bentley is not in the way."
"I have rarely known such delightful weather in what we must, I suppose, call the torrid zone," said Stephen, "dining as usual in the cabin. Balmy zephyrs, a placid ocean, two certain Hahnemann's petrels, and perhaps a third."
"It would be all very capital for a picnic with ladies on a lake, particularly if they shared your passion for singular birds. But I tell you, Stephen, that these balmy zephyrs of yours have not propelled the ship 70 sea miles between noon and noon these last 4 days. It is true that we could get along a little faster ourselves, but clearly we cannot leave the Franklin behind, and with her present rig she is but a dull sailor."
"I noticed that you have changed her elegant great triangular sail behind."
"Yes. Now that we are making progress with her lower masts, we can no longer afford that very long lateen yard. We need it for pole-to-gallants. Presently you will see that twin jury mainmast of hers replaced by something less horrible, made up from everything you can imagine by Mr. Bentley and that valuable carpenter we rescued. Upper tree, side trees, heel pieces, side fishes, cheeks, front fish and cant pieces, all scarfed, coked, bolted, hooped, and wooded together. It will be a wonderful sight when it is finished, as solid as the Ark of the Covenant. Then with that in place, and the respectable fore and mizzen we already possess, we can send up topmasts and the pole-to-gallants I was telling you about. That will be best of what breeze there is. How I long to see her royals. I have sworn not to touch my fiddle until they are set."
"You are in a great hurry to reach Peru, I find."
"Of course I am. So would you be, could you see our bread-room, our spirit-room, reckon up our water and count our pork and beef casks, with all these new hands aboard? Above all, our water. We had no time to fill at Oahu, or the Franklin would have run clear, and she having pumped all hers over the side, we are now in a sad way. There is only one thing for it. No fresh water will be allowed for washing clothes or anything else. Only a small ration for drinking, no scuttle-butts standing about, and a minimum for the steep tubs to get what salt off the pork and beef that towing them in a net over the side won't do."
"But since we can go so much faster, could you not give the Franklin a modicum, sail briskly on and let her follow? After all, Tom found his way here, he could surely find it back."
"What a fellow you are, Stephen. My whole plan is to arm her with our carronades and cruise in company, snapping up what China ships, whalers and fur traders may appear, then to send surprise in to Callao with, I hope, a captured ship or two, so that they can be disposed of there and you can go ashore. Tom will be in command. They are used to him in Callao because of the prizes he took on the way out, and the barkey will go on topping it, the privateer. And while you are looking after your affairs and Tom is victualling, watering and getting in stores, I shall cruise alone offshore, sending in captures from time to time, or at all events a boat. But without we spread more canvas, we shall never get there before we die of thirst and starvation. That is why I'm so eager to see the Franklin fully masted and looking like a Christian ship at last, instead of a goddamned curiosity.
So am I, upon my word, said Stephen, thinking of his coca leaves. I can hardly wait.
Possess yourself in patience for a day or two, and you will see her set her royals. Then that evening we shall have a concert. We may even sing.
At the time, Stephen wondered that Jack should speak so thoughtlessly, tempting a fate that he almost always placated with a perhaps, or if we are lucky, or tide and weather permitting. And Stephen being by now a thorough-going seaman, at least as far as weak superstition was concerned, he was more grieved than surprised when a top-maul fell upon Mr. Bentley's foot early the next morning. The wound was not dangerous, but it confined the carpenter to his cot for a while, and in the meantime his crew, most unhappily, fell out with the carpenter from the Franklin. The privateer had taken him from a Hull whaler, and he spoke a Yorkshire dialect almost entirely incomprehensible to the West Country hands from Shelmiston, who looked upon him with dislike and suspicion as little better than a foreigner, a French dog or a Turk. Work, therefore, went forward slowly, and not only work on the mast, but the innumerable tasks that waited on its erection, and with an equal or even greater deliberation the two ships moved over the quiet sea through this perfect picnic weather. In spite of his eagerness to be in South America, it pleased Stephen, who spread himself naked in the sun and even swam with Jack in the mornings. It pleased most of the people, who could devote themselves to a detailed reckoning of the Franklin's worth and the value of the goods she had taken out of her various prizes, and dividing the total according to each man's share. And it would have pleased the midshipmen, if the captain had not come down on them like a thousand of bricks. Football was abolished, cricket prohibited, and they were kept strictly to their duty, taking altitudes right and left, showing up their day's working, which rarely amounted to 50 miles of course made good, and writing their journals neat and fair. No blots were allowed, and a mistaken logarithm meant no supper. They walked about barefoot or in list slippers, rarely speaking above a whisper. During this time, Stephen often went forward to Mr. Bentley's cabin to dress and poultice his poor foot, and on these occasions he sometimes heard Dutour, whose quarters were close at hand, talking to his neighbour the boatswain, or to the visiting Granger or Vidal, quite frequently to more, most of them forecastle men during their watch below. Stephen did not listen particularly, but he did notice that when Dutour was speaking to one or two, his voice was that of ordinary human conversation, rather better, in fact, since he was unusually good company, but that when several were present, he tended to address them in a booming tone and to go on and on. They did not seem to dislike it, though there was little new to be said about equality, the brotherhood of man, the innate goodness and wisdom of human nature unoppressed. But then, he reflected, Dutour's hearers, Nipperdollings for the most part, were accustomed to much longer discourses at home. Mr. Bentley's innate wisdom told him that if he remained in the doctor's list much longer, the newcomer would get the credit for the Franklin's mainmast, now nearing completion in spite of doggedness on the part of the carpenter's crew, and this, though he was a good and benevolent man, he could not bear. In spite of the pain, he crossed to the prize the morning the last of the Franklin's casualties were buried. The privateer's company had not been together long enough to form a united crew, and the dead went over the side with little ceremony and less mourning. Though in the general indifference Dutour did say a few words, received with approving nods by his former shipmates before they went back to work. They had all volunteered to serve as temporary surprises, mainly, it was thought, for the sake of the tobacco. Mr. Bentley was only just in time. The captain had already gone aboard the Franklin, meaning to take advantage of the calm sea to carry out the delicate manoeuvre of getting the new mast in by the old, the composite old, for by now neither ship could provide adequate shears. With propitious weather, an eager and highly competent skipper, and an eager and highly competent first lieutenant, both of them capable of hard horse driving, there was certainly not going to be any leisure for mocking at a Yorkshire word. There was not indeed going to be loss of a single minute, and the carpenter heaved himself up the side, limping to his place by the new mainmast's heel. Nearly all the surprise's hands were aboard the prize, prepared to haul, heave, or gather up the wreckage in the by no means improbable event of accident, and it was Stephen who rowed Bentley across in his little skiff, a frightening experience. Having delivered the carpenter, he brought Martin back. The medical men had no place on the crowded, busy, anxious deck. Ropes ran in every direction, and wherever they stood, they were liable to be in the way. In any case, since those Franklins who had been left in the ship were now either healed or buried, Martin's duty there was at an end. The frigate's cook, a fine great black man with one leg and a bearded Thraskite, helped them up the side, Martin carrying his mended viola, and leaving the boat to more skilful hands, the medicos leaned on the rail for a while, watching the operations over the water.
"I wish I could explain what they are about," said Stephen, "but this is so much more complex than the business with the shears that with your own limited command of the seaman's language you might not be able to follow me. Indeed, I might even lead you into error."
"How quiet it is," said Martin. "Uncommonly quiet. A gentle heave and set, the yards and rigging answering each with a murmur, but no break and run of water, no singing of the breeze, and scarcely a word from the few hands aboard, grouped on the forecastle and gazing steadily at the Franklin."
"So quiet," said Stephen some minutes later, "that I believe I shall take advantage of it to write in peace for a while. There will soon be a stamping as of wild beasts, and cries of belay avast and masthead there." "My dearest soul," he wrote, continuing an unfinished sheet, "I have just ferried Nathaniel Martin back, and I'm afraid he regrets his return. He was happier messing along with Tom Pullings in the prize, and on the few occasions when he had come back to help me or to attend a particular dinner, I have noticed that he has seemed more ill at ease in the gunroom than he was before. We now have added to our company one of the ransomer mates, recently discharged from the sick berth, and the loud-voiced, confident mirth of the supercargo, the merchant, and his mate oppresses him. Nor can it be said that the conversation of our two acting lieutenants is enlivening. Both are eminently respectable men, but neither has enough experience of this kind of mess to keep the ransomers in order, so that in Tom's absence the place is more like the ordinary of an inferior Portsmouth tavern than the gunroom of a man of war. The officers quite often invite Dutour, and he does impose a certain respect, but unhappily he is a great talker, and in spite of some tolerably emphatic checks he will drift towards philosophic considerations bordering upon politics and religion, the politics being of the utopian, pantisocratic kind, and the religion a sort of misty deism, both of which distress Martin. The poor fellow regrets Dutour's absence and dreads his presence. I hope that our meals, and it is wonderful how long one spends at table cooped up with the other members of the mess, it seems longer when some members belch, fart, and scratch themselves, will become more tolerable when Tom returns, for I imagine the prize will be sold on the coast, and when Jack regularly dines with us. Yet even in that case I do not think Martin's is likely to be an enviable lot. In this ship there was always a prejudice against him as a cleric, an unlucky man to have aboard, and now that it is known he is a parson in fact, the rector of two of Jack's livings, the prejudice has grown. Then again, as a man of some learning, acquainted with Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, he is awkward company for our sectaries. In the event of a theological disagreement, a differing interpretation of the original, they carry no guns at all. And, of course, by definition he is opposed to dissent and favourable to episcopacy and tithes, as well as to infant baptism, abhorrent to many of our shipmates. At the same time, being a quiet, introspective man, he completely lacks the ebullient bonhomie that comes so naturally to Dutour. It is acknowledged aboard that he is a good man, kind as a surgeon's mate, and in former commissions as a letter or petition writer. Now there is little occasion for either, and our few illiterates usually go to Mr. Adams. But he is not cordially liked. He has been poor, miserably and visibly poor. Now he is, by lower deck standards, rich, and some suspect him of being over-elevated. But more than this, it is known, in a ship everything is known after the first few thousand miles, that the captain is not very fond of him. And at sea a captain's opinion is as important to his crew as that of an absolute monarch to his court. It is not that Jack has ever treated him with the least disrespect, but Martin's presence is a constraint upon him. They have little to say to one another. And in short,
Martin has not accomplished the feat of making a friend of his friend's closest associate. The attempt is rarely successful, I believe, and perhaps Martin never even ventured upon it. However that may be, they are not friends, and this means that he is looked upon by the people with less consideration than I think he deserves. It surprises me. I must say that I thought they would have used him better. Perhaps, as far as many of the ship's present crew are concerned, it is to some degree a question of these wretched tithes, which so many of them resent. And he is now one of those who receive, or at least will receive, the hated impost. In any event, I am afraid he is losing his taste for life. His pleasure in birds and marine creatures has deserted him, and an educated man who takes no delight in natural philosophy has no place in a ship, unless he is a sailor. Yet I remember him in earlier commissions, in much the same circumstances, rejoicing in the distant whale, the stink-pot petrel, his face aglow and his one eye sparkling with satisfaction. He was quite penniless then, apart from his miserable pay, and at those times when cause and effect seem childishly evident, I am inclined to blame his prosperity. He now possesses, but has never enjoyed, two livings, and what might be called a fair provision in prize money. From a worldly point of view, he is a much more considerable man than he ever has been before, although this makes no difference to his importance aboard, it will do so by land, and I think it likely that he exaggerates the happiness which ease and consequence may bring, that he pines for the shore, and its compensation for the disappointments he has suffered at sea. I have disappointed him, I am afraid, and... Stephen held his pen in the air, reflecting upon Clarissa Oakes, a young woman to whom he was much attached, a convict transported for murder who, escaping, had sailed in the frigate from Sydney Cove to Oahu. He reflected upon her, smiling, and then upon Martin's ambiguous relations with her, which might also have had a deep influence on the people's attitude. If a parson sinned, and Stephen was by no means convinced of it, his sin was multiplied by every sermon he preached. So have other people, including, no doubt, himself. Yet, like so many poor men, he almost certainly mistakes the effect of wealth upon happiness in anything but the first fine flush of possession. He speaks of money very much more often than he did, more often than is quite agreeable. And the other day, referring to his marriage, which is as nearly ideal as can be, he was so thoughtless as to say that it would be even happier with his share of our current prize. Stephen paused again, and in the silence of the ship he heard Martin playing his viola in his cabin opening off the gunroom. An ascending scale, true enough, then coming down, slower, more hesitant, and ending in a prolonged, slightly false B-flat, infinitely sad. "I do not have to tell you, my dear," he went on, "that although I speak in this high ascetic way about money, I do not, never have, despise a competence. It is the relation of superfluity to happiness that is my text, and I am holier than thou only after £200 a year." The viola had stopped, and Stephen, locking away his paper, walked into the great cabin, stretched out on the cushioned stern window locker, gazed for a while at the reflected sunlight dancing overhead, and went to sleep. He was woken, as long use had told him he would be woken, by a trampling as of wild beasts as the Surprise's boats were hoisted in. Hoarse cries,
"Oh, you impotent booby!"
The shrilling of the boatswain's call, the clash of tackles run up chock-a-block.
"Handsomely, handsomely now, or William!"
Granger to an impetuous young nephew. But then, instead of the usual cries of avast and belay, an unexpected, unanimous, good-natured cheer, accompanied by laughter. "What can this signify?" he asked himself. And while he was searching for a plausible, sea-going answer, he became aware of a presence in the cabin, a suppressed giggle. It was Emily and Sarah, standing neatly side by side in white pinafores.
"We have been standing here a great while, sir," said Sarah, "whilst you was a-contemplating. The captain says, should you like to see a marble?"
"Wonder," said Emily.
"Marble," said Sarah, adding, "you impotent booby," in a whisper.
"There you are, doctor!"
cried the captain as Stephen came on deck, still looking rather stupid.
"Have you been asleep?"
"Not at all," said Stephen.
I very rarely sleep.
Well, if you had been asleep, here is a sight that would wake you even if you were a letter to the Ephesians. Look over the leeward quarter. The leeward quarter!
Jesus, Mary and Joseph! Cried Stephen, recognizing the Franklin at last. What a transformation! She has three tall Christian masts and a vast great number of sails. What splendour in the sun! Sails of every kind, I make no doubt, including to gallant royals.
Exactly so! I never thought it could have been done in the time. She spread them not 5 minutes ago, and already she has gained on us a cable's length. A neat little craft, upon my word. We shall have to set our own. Mr. Granger!
In a louder voice.
I believe we must show her our royals.
The Surprise's royals, which were set flying, had already been bent to their yards, with the halyards hitched to the slings and the starboard arm stopped to them, the hands fidgeting to be at it. But no man laid a finger on a rope until Mr. Granger called,
Now then, George, haul away!
And the long, slim yards fairly shot up through the rigging, up and up, threading lengthways through a cat's cradle of cordage up to the masthead, where the light and nimble Abraham Dorkin cut the small stuff stopping the yard to the halyards, swung it onto the horizontal plane of the t'gallant yard, fixed it there with a becket, lashed the clews of the sails, its lower corners, to the t'gallant yard arm, cast off the beckets, and cried,
"Whoa!"
His cry almost exactly coincided with others from the fore and mizzen mastheads, and the royals flashed out at the same moment, filling at once to the gentle breeze. The Surprises cheered. From over the water the weary Franklins did the same, and Jack turned a beaming face to Stephen, his eyes more startlingly blue than ever.
"Ain't that capital?" he cried. "Now we can have our concert at last!"
"Very capital indeed, upon my soul," said Stephen, wondering why they were all so delighted.
Certainly the ships, particularly the Franklin, were more beautiful by far, with their towering clouds of ordered whiteness reducing their hulls to low, slim, elegant forms, and as he watched, the sun lit the Franklin with more than common force, causing all the staysails to make strong, exactly curved shadows on the square courses, topsails, and t'gallants behind them. Very fine indeed. And perhaps there was a just perceptible increase in their gentle pace, a very slightly greater lean from the breeze.
"Mr. Reed!" called Jack. "Pray heave the log!"
"Aye, aye, sir! Heave the log it is!"
replied Reed, all duty and submission still. The usual ceremony followed. The log ship splashed over the leeward quarter, went astern at a walking pace until it was free of what mild eddies the Surprise might make, watched with the closest attention by all hands. The moment the bunting that marked the end of the stray line went over the rail, Reed cried,
"Turn!"
and Norton turned the 28-second sand glass, holding it close to his eye. As the last grain fell, he bawled,
"Stop!"
and Reed nipped the line a little after the second knot had passed. The quartermaster holding the log reel gave the line a tweak, dislodging a pin so that the log ship floated sideways, and wound it in. Reed measured the distance between his nip and the second knot with a knowing eye.
2 knots and a trifle better than 1 fathom, sir, if you please,
he reported bareheaded to the captain.
Thank you, Mr. Reed,
said Jack, and to Stephen,
There, doctor, ain't you amazed? 2 knots and a little more than 1 fathom.
Profoundly amazed. Yet I seem to remember having gone even faster.
Why, God love you, of course you have, cried Jack. It is not the absolute speed that I'm talking about, but the relative speed, the speed in this miserable zephyr of yours. Good Lord, if we can both make better than 2 knots in an air that would scarcely bend a candle flame, there is precious little can escape us. Without it has wings, or carries 74 guns.
Hear him, hear him,
said somebody in the waist of the ship, and both helmsman and quartermaster chuckled.
To be sure, there is always the joy of the chase, said Stephen,
with what enthusiasm he could command. And after a pause, in which he felt he had been disappointing, he said,
For our concert, now, have you anything particular in mind?
Oh, old favourites, for sure, said Jack. I remember your telling me long ago, when we were beating out of Port Mahon in the Sophie, that in Spain they had a saying, Let no new thing arise. I thought at the time it might do very well for the Navy, and I'm not so sure there is not something to be said for it in music.
It was a very old favourite they began with that evening. Bender's violin and cello duet in C minor,
and they played it unusually well. There is a great deal to be said for a steady deck under a cello, a great deal to be said for a cheerful heart behind a fiddle, and they would have brought it to an unusually handsome close if Killick had not blundered in, tripping over a little stool unseen because of his tray, and saving their supper only by a miracle of juggling. At one time this supper had consisted of toasted cheese held in a remarkably elegant piece of Irish silver, a covered outer dish that held six within it, the whole kept warm over a spirit stove. The dish was still present, gleaming with a noble brilliance, but it held only a pap made of pounded biscuit, a little goat's milk, and even less of rock-hard cheese rind rasped over the top and browned with a loggerhead, so that some faint odour of cheddar could still just be made out. Jack Aubrey weighed 16 or 17 stone, Stephen barely 9, and to avoid the tedium of self-sacrifice, protests against the sacrifice, and privy maundering afterwards, it had long been agreed that they should share accordingly. Finishing his fourth dish, therefore, Jack also finished his explanation of the remarkable sailing qualities of both the Franklin and the Surprise.
"So, as I say, although at present we have the current setting against us, I believe I can promise we shall make as much of what breeze there is as any two ships afloat. From the look of the sky and the glass, I should not be astonished if we achieved 5 knots tomorrow. And then, you know, as we slant down towards the equator, there is the counter-current in our favour."
"So much the better," said Stephen. "Now what do you say to our Boccherini in D major? The minuet has been running in my head these last 2 or 3 days, but we have still to work out the adagio."
"I should like it, of all things," said Jack. "Killick, Killick there! Clear the decks and bring another decanter of port."
"Which it is getting very low, sir," said Killick. "At this rate, we shall have to rouse up your feast day 89, or be satisfied with grog."
"Rouse it up, Killick. Let us live whilst we are alive."
When Killick was gone, looking pinched and disapproving, Jack went on.
"That reminds me of Clarissa Oakes. She said something of the same kind in Latin, you told me, and translated it for her husband. Lord Stephen, that was a fine young woman. How shamefully I lusted after her! But it would not do, of course, not in my own ship. And I believe poor Martin was much smitten. Sheep's eyes were not in it. However, I do so hope she will be happy with Oakes. He was not perhaps quite up to her mark, but he was a tolerable seaman."
"Little do I know of port wine," said Stephen. "Was 89 an uncommon year?"
"Pretty good," said Jack, "but I love it because of its associations. I never drink it without thinking of the Spanish disturbance."
"My dear, you have the advantage of me."
"Really? Well, I am amazingly glad to know something you do not. It had to do with Nootka Sound, the place where the fur traders go. Captain Cook, that great man, discovered it during his last voyage, when he was running up the northwest coast of America, and our people had been trading there and to the northwards for years and years, when all at once the Spaniards said it was a continuation of California, and therefore Spanish. They sent up a 26-gun frigate from Mexico and seized the English ships and the settlement. It made a great noise when the news reached home, above all as we had not long since been beaten in America. People were furiously angry. My cousin Edward stood up in Parliament beside himself with rage and said England was going to the dogs, and the House cheered him. And when the Spaniards would not listen to reason, the ministry began hurrying ships out of ordinary, manning them with a hot press, and laying down new ones. Lord, we were so happy, we sailors, turned ashore after the American disaster. One day I was only a wretched master's mate with no half-pay, glum, blue, hipped, sitting on the beach and adding salt tears to the bitter flood, and the next I was Lieutenant Aubrey, 5th of the Queen, covered with glory and gold lace, or at least as much as I could get on credit. It was a wonderful stroke of luck for me, and for the country, too."
"Who could deny it?"
"I mean, it was wonderfully well-timed, since it meant we had a well-manned, well-equipped navy to cope with the French when they declared war on us a little later. Bless the Spanish disturbance."
"By all means. But, Jack, I could have sworn your commission was dated 1792. Sophie showed it to me with such pride. Yet our wine is 1789.
"Of course it is. That was when the disturbance started, the very beginning, when those wicked dogs seized our ships. The talking and the rearmament went on until 92, when the Spaniards pulled in their horns as they did over the Falklands some time before, but it all began in 89. A precious date for me. A wonderful year, and I had great hopes of it as soon as the news came home."
He paused for a while, sipping his port and smiling at his recollections. Then he said,
"Tell me, Stephen, what were you doing in 89?
"Oh," said Stephen vaguely, "I was studying medicine." With this he set down his glass and walked into the quarter gallery. He had been studying medicine, it was true, walking the wards of the Hôtel Dieu, but he had also spent a great deal of the time running about the streets of Paris in the headiest state of happy excitement that could be imagined, or rather exultation, in the dawn of the revolution, when every disinterested, generous idea of freedom seemed on the point of realization, the dawn of an infinitely finer age. When he came back, he found Jack arranging the score of their next duet on their music stands. Like many other heavy men, Jack could be as sensitive as a cat on occasion. He knew that he had touched on some painful area, that in any case Stephen hated questions, and he was particularly attentive in laying out the sheets, pouring Stephen another glass of wine, and, when they began, in so playing that his violin helped the cello, yielding to it in those minute ways perceptible to those who are deep in their music, if to few others. They played on, and only once did Jack raise his head from the score. The ship was leaning half astrake, and beneath their strings the sound of the rigging could just be heard. At the end of the allegro, he said, turning the page with his bow,
"She is making 4 knots.
"I believe we may attack the adagio directly," said Stephen. "The wind is in our poop, and we have never played better." They swept into the next movement, the cello booming nobly, and carried straight on without a pause, separating, joining, answering one another, with never a hesitation or a false note, until the full satisfaction of the end.
"Well done, well done," said Dutour.
He and Martin were standing in the warm darkness abaft the lit companion, alone on the quarterdeck apart from Granger and the men at the wheel.
"I had no idea they could play so well. No contention, no striving for preeminence. Pray, which is the cello?"
"Dr. Maturin."
"And Captain Aubrey the violin, of course. Admirable tone, admirable bowing."
Martin did not care for Dutour in the gunroom. He thought that the Frenchman talked far too much, that he tended to harangue the company, and that his ideas, though no doubt well-intended, were pernicious. But en tête-à-tête, Dutour was an agreeable companion, and Martin quite often took a turn on deck with him.
"You play yourself, sir, I collect," he said.
"Yes, I may be said to play. I am not of the captain's standard, but with some practice I believe I could play second fiddle to him without too much discredit.
Have you a violin with you?"
"Yes, yes, it is in my sea chest. The man who repaired your viola renewed the pegs just before we set off from Molokai. Do you often play in the cabin?"
"I have done so, though I am an indifferent performer. I have taken part in quartets."
"Quartets? What joy! That is living in the very heart of music."